Welcome to the Parallel Lives Institute for Scintillating Social Storytelling. The voice whispers, ghost-like from the old oversized speakers in the corners of the room. It's some kind of doctor's office? The phrase seems like one that you feel perhaps you ought to remember. And yet, you can't seem to. In fact, you can't remember anything at all. Can you? How distressing. The voice continues, though, and you are not sure whether to tense or relax. Before we proceed, you must understand that whatever you did in your past is in the past. You do not have control over what has gone before. As the treatment progresses, you may discover that the person you were does not match your expectations. Indeed, the person you were may turn out to be someone you do not now wish to be. The cause of your trauma might be something accidental that you blame yourself for, but it might be some intentional act that you undertook with full knowledge of the consequences. Are we ready, then? Please, direct your attention to the bowl of pennies in the center of the table, and we shall begin. Hey, this is Bram, your host, and today I am joined by Charles and Olivia D, and we are looking at A Penny for Your Thoughts by Paul Tevis and Evil Hat Productions.
We are probably joined as a co-star by our cat Marlo, who is just very loud. I did just feed him, though, and that might buy us some time.
We'll do our best for you, but yeah, there's probably going to be some yowling.
Meow.
That was Bram doing a really good impression of our cat.
You can... So. Basically tell I've studied with cats. I have a degree in cat.
I do remember that after your parents were murdered, you did leave the city and travel the world studying under some of the world's greatest cats to learn their ways.
Yeah, the cat who falls.
Exactly.
As you can tell, this is a game about memory. This is actually the second recording of our talk about A Penny for Your Thoughts.
My thoughts.
A Penny for My Thoughts.
It's okay, we'll screw it up constantly, I'm sure.
Yeah. The first one, I felt... And maybe I'm crazy. Had just the worst audio, so this is for your sake. So, the basic shtick of A Penny for Your Thoughts is that everyone has had a traumatic experience. They have had full memory loss, and now they are together in the Orphic Institute to try and reclaim these lost memories.
So the first thing that you'll notice about A Penny for My Thoughts, if you go to play it, is that the manual is written in character. The manual introduces itself to you as like, oh, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and explains to you that situation. So this is a game that, unlike any game I've ever played, requires absolutely no prep work, because...
You do not have to learn the rules before sitting down.
Nope. In fact, it is built in that someone, in our case Bram, reads the rules to the other players as part of play.
You might be skeptical of how well that goes, but actually I thought there was really no trouble. It worked pretty well.
Pretty seamless, yeah. I thought that was a success.
The only thing that I could remotely call an absence of success is that, like, halfway through the game where we all sort of looked at each other and went, oh, I wonder how this game is supposed to end. But no problems were caused.
A thumbs up for your thoughts. Or my thoughts? I can't remember.
It's my thoughts.
A thumbs up for my thoughts. Two thumbs up. The basic premise of this, like I said, is you're all together in the Orphic Institute. You've lost your memories, but you don't know how. They have dosed you with a drug called Nemesine, doesn't matter, which lets you all experience each other's memories and basically walk down the path together of your life and find out why you came to be here.
You hear each other's memories as echoes.
Echoes.
Another thing that the game comes with that I think is really helpful and interesting is it has a facts and reassurances document, and the way that the book phrases this is like, so someone in your position might be a little bit confused for obvious reasons, so we've provided this document to tell you a little bit about the world you're living in. And there are actually several facts and reassurances documents in the back of the book that you can use for basically different modules. The one that we used assures us that we... live in a mundane world, we are all normal people, and gosh, were we all normal people. The most normal of all the people I've ever played in a role-playing game. And the reason that we lost our memories is some form of trauma. We feel guilty about something, whether or not it was our fault. Our memories gone, and our brains are not allowing us to heal. So we're not superheroes. The world is mundane.
If you don't remember us describing this, it's because you've probably lost your memory. We're going to help you reclaim it.
It's a really good idea. It's another one of the features in the game that I think does really do its job, and it really works because it sets very clear genre and setting expectations, which is really good if you're Raven.
The other facts and reassurances documents that the game comes with are one where... So the mundane one is, it says, like, oh, there is no shadowy government conspiracy. This is just personal trauma. And one of them is, there is a shadowy government conspiracy. You are a secret agent. And the last one is Lovecraft-themed.
You'd probably add your own with basically no trouble. I think it would be pretty easy.
We'll come to that.
Ooh. Penny, for your thoughts, needs one specific prop, and that is a jar full of pennies, a bowl full of pennies, and...
a bucket. Just a penny bucket.
A sea full of pennies. You can Scrooge McDuck it.
Yeah, if you have a cistern, ideally filled with copper, you're in a good place.
Penny for Your Thoughts by Karl Barks.
You only need a bowl, and you only need, like, 30 pennies.
It recommends about 4 pennies per player.
Approximately 75 pennies per player by the end of the game.
we'll get to that. So the way the game is played is you don't know who you are, and your fellow players are going to help you learn that. And one of the things that helps you learn that is everybody at the beginning of the game writes down 5 memory triggers, which are sort of objects or feelings or sensations that might be tied to a specific recollection. And you all write these down. Examples from our game were...
starting an ill-advised high school punk band.
A worn-out teddy bear.
A drop of blood in a sink.
A wilted four-leaf clover.
The feeling of mist hiding a larger world.
Feeling of knowing for weeks that you're going to have to do it.
And I think this is another feature that actually the game gets right and works pretty well. I know that's another thing that I think we all did enjoy, is that it's fairly fun to generate these. It's fun and surprising to draw them, and they will force you to think on your feet.
I think a lot of games would have gone the route maybe of having a nice table for these things, and you just like decide from a table what it is. And there's nothing wrong with that particularly, but actually it's a lot of fun to know that you have put these things in, to see other people draw the triggers that you've written, or yourself draw a trigger that you've written and you didn't want to draw, as happened twice during this game.
It's fun to watch, because sometimes I would write triggers with, you know, something vaguely in mind about what they meant or what might be connected to them. And so it's fun to write a trigger and to see where that trigger ends up.
And, I mean, 35% chance at a zoo, in a zoo, related to a zoo. But I think that might just be us. I'm not sure that that's endemic to the system.
Charles is getting at 2 things, and the first of which is...
Zoos.
No, the first of which is, ever since Shannon and I were so upset by the prospect of, like, a sad zoo struggling to survive as a fiasco module, Charles has been doing his level fucking best to just shoehorn zoos in.
Zoohorn.
Yeah.
I said that last recording, I'll say it this recording.
I know, I was ready for it, and I still feel bad. And the second thing that Charles is getting at is that not once, but twice, did sad zoos come up in this playthrough of A Penny for My Thoughts.
And once it was not my fault.
Yeah, no, Bram colluded. Without...
accidentally.
On accident.
Once you have your memory trigger, the book encourages you to do a number of silly things, and we will talk about that at length. But this is one of the first ones where, like look at the shape of the letter on the page, like, let it really sink in, this memory trigger.
Everything short of basically, like, licking it, yeah.
Yeah.
The way in which the rules are in character, I don't know if this is where some of the game's very peculiar aesthetic decisions come from. Is I don't know if that's the point they flow out from, but it feels like it might be for some of it. And we have not yet begun to handle the way in which this game really has an aesthetic that it's going for, but we'll get there.
Most of the parts of the game seem to flow around the aesthetic, except for the art direction, which unfortunately I don't think was very good.
The art direction is a little bit like...
game designer and friends, lab coats their own.
No, and like top secret, like files released, like that's that sort of aesthetic.
In a role-playing game, if your worst sin is bad art direction, I think you're doing okay.
But
shout out to the Book of Erotic Fantasy.
Not XX Exalted.
Oh man, is that a thing?
Yeah.
God, I hope so.
No.
No, what happens when my unstoppable force meets someone else's immovable object?
Oh, let's not talk about this anymore. Unless we're going to play XX Exalted, because...
We're probably not, because that involves playing Exalted.
Is that and is that a fork of Xenophile? I can never remember. That's how you pronounce that, right?
Probably.
So once you have your memory trigger, what happens is that the other players ask you yes or no questions about that trigger. This is the first thing the game mandates that you say, is you have to answer that question, yes, and... And this is super fun, because it just allows your co-players to shoehorn you into weird things.
And one of the things that's cool about that is, one of the particular pleasures of this system is that you'll very much get to inject complication into other people's stories. And that process turns out to be a lot of fun. There is a real, like, tricksterish screwing with your friends element to this system.
Did you mean to kill him?
Yeah, exactly. Like, do you often destroy things out of spite when you're upset?
Have you stopped beating your wife?
These would all be questions somehow related to the memory trigger you drew at this point.
Or at least that would build off of each other.
Yeah. And these form together to make the basis of a memory.
And this is also the first point where the game's aesthetic bent and its desire for a very particular kind of discursive structure will begin to get in the way. This is going to be a theme as we go forward, but because the question you ask must be answerable with yes and, you can ask, have you stopped beating your wife? But you cannot ask, when did you stop beating your wife? Because they cannot answer that yes and. Right off the bat, we see this thing where the system creates certain kinds of complications very well, but if you wanted to ask a when question, you'd have to go through some circumlocution to do it.
And I definitely think that, especially if you are more used to playing this game, if you are most of the way through a session, for example, or in your second or third session, you can absolutely, I think, start asking questions that begin with how or why. And I don't think that that will break or harm the game. I don't think that it will give the person answering too much control. Because I think the part of the point of saying yes and is you go with the person's suggestion and you take it and you run with it. And I think you can take and run with how questions and where questions and why questions. You just have to remember that when somebody asks you a question, you're supposed to run with it.
Yes and is good training wheels for starting off, but you could probably dispense with the rigid structure of this questioning without breaking the spirit of what the game wants you to be doing.
Basically, everybody gets to ask one question, and once this is done, you say, I remember a time when, and you string the answers to those questions together to form something of a narrative. So if, for example, you were to discover that your cat had died, but you weren't super unhappy about it, but someone else was really unhappy about it, and you had a really wonderful cat funeral, that was basically the answers to your yes or no questions. You might string that together such that, like, well, I was 5 years old, and my cat had died, and I was much less upset than my mom, and so on and so forth.
Parallel Lives, a really wonderful cat funeral.
A really wonderful cat funeral. Another one of the themes of this game, by the way, dead animals.
Yeah, dogs. It's all dogs.
Woof, woof.
Because remember that the basic premise of this game is everyone had something terrible happen. Thankfully, you're all on drugs. So necessarily, this is a tragedy generator. No one is having a good time coming into this. Like, I guess you could try to make it so that something amusing happened and it resulted in cartoon movie-grade amnesia, but, like, you would be fighting the format.
Red Kryptonite.
Yeah, you are supposed to, like, this... Your mind won't let it...
Dick, or is that the...
Red Kryptonite has a random effect each time, but never repeats itself unless it's a special piece of Red Kryptonite that went through extra radiation in which it pays it repeats the effect of old Red Kryptonite.
Nerds, 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 nerds.
That is monstrous. And also just, it's just like a self-aware mineral.
That's where, like, your Lionhead Superman comes from.
Oh, God.
Black Kryptonite makes him a jerk.
Now I can't remember my place, and I'm thinking about all the different colors of kryptonite. It has to be a tragedy generator, because the reason you're here is your mind won't let yourself heal because you feel so bad about something that happened. So something truly tragic has actually occurred, and I don't think that the system particularly allows for goofiness.
And so once again, we're definitely going to end up with a system that is, much like Fiasco, going to focus a lot on petty human evil. But, for other structural reasons, the evil in our game will end up less petty and, kind of less human.
A, sort of, and B, like, yeah, this game is a lot like Fiasco, but I do think it is less funny, and certainly less meant to be funny. But,
Pennies.
Pennies! Yes, actually, we're getting into the pennies part.
This is a game with several of your friends, as long as one of your friends is Abraham Lincoln.
We've talked a little bit about the way that turn structure goes. Turns are sort of tripartite affairs in this game, and phase one is that yes or no, back and forth dialogue. And the second phase is the remember a time when.
Yeah, the summary.
Yeah, where you summarize the events suggested by the results of that dialogue. And a difficulty I had here is that the third part of your turn is what happens after the scene described by the answers to the dialogue in the first part.
While it might seem to you at first that, especially since you've just answered all of these questions, the scene you're going to talk about is going to be the cat funeral, that's not true. What happens is there was a wonderful cat funeral, and then
the tension that this introduces is you'll get this interesting memory trigger, you'll build this interesting event around it as your friends throw curveballs at you and force strange implications into your words, to which you must always yes and. You'll batter that weird object into a narrative, and then the lion's share of your turn will be aftermath to that. It's sort of scene one is the war, and then the scene that will be the most of the time and most of the role-playing in your turn will be the boat ride home, which I found a pretty odd tension, and we managed it okay. Like, I don't think we had, you know, third parts of turns that were awful, but it's very counterintuitive the first time you're going through it.
I did not find this particularly counterintuitive for two reasons. The first of which is, if your yes or no section leads into a place where you can just have a scene that's in the war, congratulations, you're in the war now. And so, quick confession, I am a person who, unlike these other people, I have played 4 games of A Penny for My Thoughts.
Oh, that's much more since the last recording.
Yeah! I'll get to it. I've played a bunch of, actually, 2-player games of A Penny for My Thoughts. And so I've definitely had scenes where the prologue leads directly into those action-packed events that Charles is looking for. On the other hand, however, I also feel like, even if it doesn't, first of all, this is a game about aftermath, because we're all having retrograde amnesia, so we start in the aftermath, and so it makes sense to me that we all just live there permanently, and that a lot of what we're dealing with is aftermath. And second of all, it's not just the boat ride home, but it's the boat ride home where you're struggling with your PTSD, or you're dealing with whatever emotional things happen in the war. It is the emotional aftermath. It is where you discover what the war meant for you and to you. And I can see how living there and telling your story there could feel unusual, but to me it made plenty of sense.
To me, the trouble was less that and more like you've spent a lot of time now establishing a thing. And then you have to be like, okay, so I know all this stuff. I know that I've had a wonderful cat funeral. And now it's just time for me to start a scene. And then you have to think about, wait, what happened next? I have no idea.
What happens ex post cat funeral?
Yeah. And sometimes this will come to you pretty well. Sometimes it won't.
Regardless of how you get to your final scene and how much trouble you have with it, what you do is, so you don't remember anything, and in fact, your co-players are more connected to your memories than you are. And so you start narrating a scene, and you are allowed to describe the actions of others, the setting, the dialogue of others, and your own feelings. But you are not allowed to describe significant actions or dialogue of your own. So when you get to a point where you're about to say or do something important, you have to stop. and you have to look to your other players and say, what did I say or do next?
This is the part where pennies come in, by the way. So yeah. We've been teasing you with small denominations of money. But what it is you each start out with a penny, I want to say, more or less.
Yeah, one penny.
Someone ends up starting with a couple of pennies instead of just one. How it doesn't matter. And at each decision point, you ask, what do I say or do then? You look between people, you ask one person, and they'll be like, you took out your knife, and you smiled like a crazy person, and you chased them down. Probably what happens after a cat funeral.
I was six!
And it was a hard time. And then you nod sagely, and then you turn to another friend, and you say, or was it? And then they offer an alternative, and so I'm like, maybe instead you burst into tears and curled into a ball.
So eagle-eyed readers here will notice that there are the presence of two code phrases in this game interaction alone, which you will repeat once to about 75 times per scene.
Especially eagle-eyed because we're talking.
Yeah.
If you can hear sound waves, do eagles have good ears? I know they have ears, actually. We're not going to ask that question. I know that birds can hear.
Also, yes, we can hear sound waves. So this part where you have to stop and ask what people are doing is great.
Oh, it's the best.
Yeah, it has some flaws, which I'll get to in a sec, but it's super fun to just mandate someone's actions to make up something weird and potentially force them on it, and also to have one person say, like, you fail. And you go, like, okay, or was it? And the other person says, like, oh, you fail. But, like, maybe in a different way.
Briefly, what it is you get these two choices, and then you have to choose between them. You don't get to keep looking between your friends, desperately hoping for something more. And then once you've chosen one, you say, okay, and you hand them one of your pennies, and that's how you tick down your turn there slowly. And then you have to go, and that is canon, and that is what happened.
Additionally, there's another aesthetic point here, which is that you do have to repeat what they said word for word, which I think is another one of the ways in which the game seeks to drive home the way in which you're not the person in control of your story. You don't get to take what they said and sort of riff on it and put your own little spin. They want it word for word. And again, this is another one of those things that, like the yes and before it, I'm sure you could theoretically dispense with. I'm just not sure how untrue to the aesthetic goals of the creators it would be for you to do so. And additionally, in our game, we did run into a very particular problem. And you will run into this in yours. On a long enough time, I might guarantee, if you play this game, you will have this happen. Which is someone who really wants to communicate what they're trying to get across with their option for you. Mm. And so they will give you a nigh unto a paragraph describing setting, characters, motivations, and what you thought about it, and why you did it just that way and not another. And then it is your job, by the rules, by the way, to read that paragraph back to them. And at a certain point, it will become ludicrous. And Olivia really wants to talk because she knows what her sin is. She knows.
I have a problem.
But no, we had a culprit. We had a bad cat. Sorry.
I didn't fuck up that often. Not that often.
I, for one, mostly liked repeating back word for word. It made it feel a little bit like a therapy session. And a little bit, it felt like someone was really in control of your memories, which is sort of a cool feeling.
I think that dropping the necessity of repeating things word for word might significantly change the aesthetic, but I don't think it will significantly change the type or quality of stories that you're able to tell. So if your primary desire is to have a storytelling experience, I think you can drop a lot of these aesthetic things, like, instantly.
Yeah, it's probably pretty easy to sort of deracinate the game from its frame narrative in, like, this is a therapy session, these are your friends who are on drugs who are helping you, and still end up with a game that has that basic through line of amnesia and other people helping you discover your past, without maintaining as strict a grasp on the code phrases that this game wants you to use in order to attain that experience.
The game has a very definite aesthetic that they're going for that is sort of cute, but mostly actually unnecessary.
Your drinking game for this episode, by the way, is do a shot every time we say the word aesthetic, because it's going to come up a lot.
We're the tumbler,
don't do it with shots.
It's us.
Do it with beer. We'll get to the party game assessment later, but this is... I think this is a beer game, not a vodka game. Would you concur with that?
Yes.
Bram?
Man, I don't drink.
Perfect. All right, so there you have it. Beer game, maybe beer game. I don't drink. Why did you just ask me?
A beer for your thoughts? I don't know, man.
Oh, man, a beer for your thoughts.
You're all amnesiacs in a bar.
Oh, you drunk.
I actually really like
away.
This. I'm yeah, sure. No.
Yeah, it's probably pretty good, actually.
Yeah, this is
I'm not sure this is Penny Prime. I'm not sure this is our inevitable Prime version of this.
Oh, we have several Prime versions.
We have several Prime versions
them.
Of yeah. them. Yeah, and almost none of them. Complicated sexual roleplay scenario generators.
Almost.
Almost.
The one
sweet
thing,
nothings for your thoughts. Sorry, go on.
Sweet nothings for your thoughts. Ah, yes. The one
a penny
thing that
for I'm your cocks.
Guys. The one thing that I will say about the penny handing mechanic is that it makes the storytelling a little bit competitive. And this is really fun because somebody offers up a really good option and you choose it. You're like, oh man, now I'm on the spot. I have to choose something that competes with that. And it's fun to have your options get chosen and so on and so forth. However, if you like someone's options less than someone else's consistently, that's gonna be a little bit of a feel bad. And
congratulations, you're just going to leave your friend out of that game they're in.
Yeah, so you're either going to leave them out, or you're going to have to ask them things, and you're going to have to ask them things potentially to the detriment of your story. And so that's a little bit of a complication that I don't quite know how to deal with.
To what extent do we think this is a game, and we've always assessed whether, to what extent do you need to be a witty person in order for this role-playing game to turn out well? And with Fiasco, the answer was there are definite returns to being sharp-witted folks. Is this above or below Fiasco, do we think?
I would say below Fiasco. This is a game that does not necessarily need to be funny, although it maybe doesn't hurt. I was going to say briefly, though, my recommended number of players for this game is 3 people, because then you're always asking everyone, and everyone's always involved.
No one is ever last picked for the narrative team.
We played with 4 people. I think it went just a little long. Maybe more than a little long? I don't
more
know.
More than
Charles.
A little for me, yeah. Okay. It's okay. We'll hit length, actually, once we're at, like, the final act of the story, because that's where it really shows up. But yeah, that's, to the surprise of no one here assembled, probably my major problem with the game is that I think it has a pacing problem.
Mm. Yeah.
And by extension, a length problem.
Though I think fixable pacing problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I concur with Bram. I've played a bunch of 2-player games of A Penny for My Thoughts. They are really quite brisk, but I think that things do suffer a little bit from a lack of variation. I think both 4 players and 2 players have distinct problems, and I think both of those sets of problems are solved by playing it with 3.
It's worth noting, this game is not technically meant to be played with 2 players. 3 is the supposed minimum. You can play with 2 players if you fudge a bit of the rules, and it's okay.
Yeah, I'm hacking it.
But that's worth noting.
Yeah. We've been focusing thus far on the experience of being the people providing the answers to the person whose turn it is. We should probably look a little bit at the way that the person actually playing out the turn gets these options. Because I think that's another thing that worked well, is that you're sort of playing ad hoc choose your own adventure. And when it comes time to make a big character decision, or make a big plot moment happen, you can start to outsource it a little bit, because everyone else has been listening to the setup, so they've already been prepping, presuming your friends are on the ball and working with you. And as you hit that moment when a decision must be made and forks diverge in a wood and someone has to take a side, you get to turn that over to other people, audition the best pair of ideas that people can come up with on the fly, and you get to choose between them. And that's actually, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah.
I already said that memory triggers were a lot of fun, but the most fun to have in the game comes from both sides of the part of the game where it becomes a choose-your-own-adventure book are great. Giving the choose-your-own-adventure options to people are lots of fun and can make the game go in cool in different ways that they weren't expecting, and makes you feel good and makes them have to suddenly fiddle around and realize that the story is very different than it was a second ago. And the part where you are on the other side of that and suddenly your story is transformed from these decisions is pretty cool.
This is, I think, a good segue into 2 things. First of which is an answer to the question that Charles asked earlier, where is this game best played with witty people? And I think any game is best played with witty people, and we sure did laugh a lot while playing this game. But I think a little bit more important than wit in A Penny for My Thoughts is the ability to provide things that are interesting and fun left turns. So if you find yourself really drawn into like, tropey and linear thinking, you might not be able to play this game such that you tell a really interesting story. But if you can pull a left turn on somebody and force them in an unexpected and odd direction, that's where I think the most fun is had.
So the deal with these pennies is that they measure how many decision points you're going to have during a scene. Every time you finish a scene, you'll take another penny from the bowl. And whenever you take a penny from the bowl, you have to say a penny from my thoughts.
You must.
That's how this game is like. And whenever you give a choice that someone likes, you get another penny. So throughout the game, you're slowly accumulating more and more such that your first scene is going to be a couple of decision points, your second scene is going to be some number more than that, and then your third scene is going to be infinite.
Your first scene is going to be 2. Your second scene is going to be probably either 3 or 4. And your third scene, which is the final scene, requires 4 pennies to start. We all, even in a 2-player game, I think you end up with 5 pennies. And I think poor Charles, had a final scene where he had to go through 6 decision points.
Yeah. Charles's final scene, and the reason that he might think this game takes a long time is because actually his final scene took about 7 years real time.
Yeah, we are all much older than we were.
Yeah. The game is a nested set of 3-act structures, which is to say each turn constitutes 3 parts, and there are 3 turns for each player. Those turns encompass a pleasant memory, an unpleasant memory, and finally a memory about why you are now at the Orphic Institute or how you were traumatized.
How did you lose your memory is the question.
Yeah, how did you lose your memory? You're right.
What brought you here? Why are you now energy sculpting, etc.?
And this might actually be a small downside to the way that we... might even be a downside to the way that reading the rules as you go biases you in strange ways. But we can talk now about what our pleasant memories were and why none of us bothered to have something that was a pleasant memory unless you bent yourself over backwards.
Well, so you and Shannon went first, and, like, Shannon's first memory, she really had to twist to make it pleasant. You sort of had to twist. I didn't. And Ram, I think, went last.
My memory was fine.
Yeah, and when I was asking you yes or no questions, I deliberately steered you towards happiness.
What it is because we didn't look very closely at these sheets at first, we didn't realize that the first memory is supposed to be pleasant at first, and that's why Shannon's first memory was about losing her child, basically.
Yeah, Shannon got teen pregnant and decided to donate the baby to some neighbors of hers. This caused a breakup in her relationship, and also it caused her, like, I think it was an option that she chose, and I don't remember what it was set up against, but, like, you know, she got, like, an or was it that was Charles's, and it was something like, you walk away from, you know, your daughter in the arms of these neighbors, and you have the distinct recollection of this being a lot like taking your dog to be put down.
Dead dog counter.
1. But, like, ultimately, the way that this turns out to be happy is that she's filled with resolve, and she has made this decision for herself. And she gets to keep her freedom, and that's why it's a happy memory, even though it reminds her of her dead dog.
Woof. Woof indeed. My first scene, I get a wilted 4-leaf clover, and it's up to me to figure out what a wilted 4-leaf clover plus memory is, which is not actually all that hard, I think. You, like, have a fun time picking clovers with your friend. You keep it for later, but remember it fondly. But mine was weird, because in the question and answer portion, the yes-anding portion, it got fiated that the clover was stolen from me, and I was planning to get it back.
It was stolen from you by the person who you had picked it with after you and that person had had a lovely conversation about the fact that you had picked this clover.
No, so my story took a weird-ass left turn right out of the gate.
One of the custom rules that we decided for some reason, but then stuck with for this game, was the no takesy backsies clause.
No takesy backsies. Absolutely key. I do recommend it, actually. I thought it made our game better.
No, I mean, I don't regret it. I have no idea where it came from or why we instituted it.
Oh, I uttered it. Yeah, I said those words.
And then we,
yeah.
No, suddenly it was gospel.
It's my stentorian tone.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
When I say things, they just become truths. A very certain and limited sort.
Charles Worldmaker.
Dream Weaver.
Tail
Spinner.
The key here is that, right off the bat, Charles's first scene was sort of strange. It had a detail that seemed extraneous. We didn't know anything about it or why it was like that. That'll come back, and I think you'll find it actually slots together pretty well in the end. And that's an interesting thing about how this game's narrative has to be formed sometimes in pieces that click together in strange ways.
Yeah, I suppose there's a little bit more to say about that scene in that it... Is this where he gets a name? Does my secondary character... We have one secondary character for me, really. Is it Steve?
Mark?
Sorry. I don't actually remember any characters whose names aren't James.
Weird running themes.
Yeah, no. Running themes, zoos, the name James, and dead animals, wherever we can get them.
Have you had any other characters named James in the podcast? Was there your scientist at James?
Yeah. Okay. Charles's character in both Dread and also horror games? And also Abnormal has been named James.
Okay. Yeah. I know that wasn't his name in Ruben Drive.
Abnormal, by the way, is your that word is your preview of an upcoming cast where we will play the body horror game Abnormal, and I will be James.
Spoilers.
I was fairly fond of that character, but I didn't actually do very much with him. And it's completely not germane to this. So
no!
Let's talk about my nameless, eventually gendered character. My first backstory encompasses... Initially, a memory about picking four-leaf clovers and saving one and preserving it, and later meeting back up with the friend with whom I picked the clovers after college, me disclosing that the clover was still in my possession, and then my friend stealing it from me. And that is a pleasant memory because I realized that the clover still meant things to him.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was a little bit of a contortion. Like, that's... unbalance a bit of a contortion to be happy.
No, you had to squeeze.
Yeah.
My memory, I won a bunch of money. Let's talk about Olivia's memory.
Yep, that's pretty much, yeah.
I don't think that's doing justice to your first scene. One of the things that I found interesting about this game is the way that our first scenes all connected deeply and actually set up the themes for the rest of our games. And, like, you're lighting the way that you become wealthy and you start to do things with your wealth. You set up a scholarship. That was important.
For the record, my first memory trigger was putting my last dollar into a casino machine.
Yeah,
what's the
slot
word for
machine.
This? Yeah. The feeling of your last dollar falling into a slot machine or something like that. Olivia was very nice. She asked me, how did you, something, you want a bunch of money, right?
I mean, I think that it was...
That's good. That is good radio right there.
I'm really good at a penny for my thoughts. No, I think I asked you, were you laughing when you handed your debtors that envelope full of money, knowing you had some to spare?
Right, yeah. This did connect a lot to my character and their experience as it went in. Compared to the other three beginning scenes, it's relatively simple. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on it.
My memory trigger was... the feeling that fog hides a much larger world.
This is a canonical crossover with Narnia.
Yeah. I can't remember exactly how my questions went, but they basically entailed me finding a dog in the fog and going on adventures with that dog in the swamp near to where I lived, which is to say, I went... on Fog Dog Bog Slogs. And so my prologue is sort of this idyllic childhood where me and my fog dog go on these lovely adventures.
Yeah, Fog Dog Bog Slog prologue.
Woo! Yes! Accurate. Ugh. And so my scene, again, because happiness is something impossible for us, I guess, was I'm leaving for college and I'm leaving my beloved fog dog behind. And so I engineer the perfect day for my dog. And then I discover the next morning that I wake up and my dog is just going about dog business. Because...
Oh, dog business. He's like a little dog salary man. He's like a little suit.
Little suit. I've got business in the
world. Woof, woof, stocks.
I have to smell things. It's great because last time I'll eventually go to a humane society, and I did call it a homeless shelter for dogs. you mocked me endlessly.
It was a very funny phrasing you chose, and we were all very interested in the dog economy and these dogs that did not have jobs, in contrast to those other earning dogs.
World building.
There was a dog combust. Anyway.
And she will not let that punchline.
I thought it was
from
funny.
From the previous recording.
Yeah, so is dog-tonomy. Whatever.
Running theme?
Dogs with jobs. So it's where my dog has gone off on, like, doggy business, and I realize that, you know, I'd engineered this special perfect day for my dog, but my dog didn't realize that anything sad was happening. And so my memory ended up being pleasant, although it was very bittersweet and very, like, actually sad, because I realized, like, this is very painful for me, but for this dog that I love, it's not actually painful. My dog's going to be okay.
The tragedy generator starts whirring, and its gears are greased with dead dog. Although I'm gunning from scene one for that dog's head on a pike, and I don't get it.
I
managed to maneuver
it.
Your story in such a way that I do not get to put that dog in the ground.
It dies off screen.
Scene two. In which we are actually allowed to have unpleasant memories rather than awful memories that we must then wildly spin until they are pleasant.
I think probably it would have been easier for us to have good memories from the start if we'd realized that was what we were supposed to do.
In the games I've played later, all of the memories that we've had that have been pleasant, we didn't have such a hard time.
I'm willing to say that was our fault.
That one is on us. We could have been nicer to each other.
Anyway, scene two, sad town. At this point, we all have more pennies. Charles has more and more pennies. And this is the point where things start getting spicy. I think especially for Charles.
Definitely for me, actually. I have one of the, like, probably the defining moment of the way that this system worked and did something cool and unexpected, actually, in my scene. But I think we're looking at Shannon's first, usually, so we'll keep our parallels.
Oh, I didn't even realize. Yeah, okay,
yeah,
sure.
No.
Cool, yeah. So Shannon's scene is Sad Zoo, which is to say her memory was the feeling of the first time you see a giraffe, which Charles can use for plausible deniability about zoos, I guess.
In my head, I was not thinking of zoos when I made it. I was just like, what is an odd sight, but a possible human one?
Yeah.
But something that you would have to find notable, but also isn't utterly insane. I was like, seeing some sort of animal that isn't from around these parts. What about a giraffe? A giraffe.
I, for one, was hoping that it was going to be Shannon on safari, but it ended up being that she saw a giraffe. For some reason, this reminded her of her daughter, like she could have been seeing that giraffe with her kid.
For some reason. Like, I don't know. She's a grown-ass woman, and she's at a zoo, and she's seeing this wondrous sight for a first time, and she thinks to herself, like, oh, zoos are a thing. My daughter and I could be seeing this thing for the first time.
I wonder
together.
If you're the first person to describe a giraffe as wondrous and not super goofy.
No, really very silly.
They're great. Oh, is that the time for me to...
tongue and stupid nose.
I could share so many giraffe facts right now, you guys.
Look, giraffe facts can be the next mini-cast.
Bear us.
Giraffe
They're
facts
great.
With Olivia Davis. Anyways.
They have a sponge in their brain.
Well, that's gross. Sponges are gross.
Yeah, it's a hideous blood sponge.
Parallel Lives.
Wondrous.
Hideous blood sponge. Anyways, so she decides that she's going to see a baby rhino up at a different zoo, and she arrives too late because she's a screw-up, so she decides she's going to break in. That was one of the things she asked us about, and that's what we told her she was going to do. She ends up wandering in the dark, she runs away from flashlights, and she ends up in the lizard exhibit.
Sobbing in the reptile house.
Hating snakes.
Yes. And at this point, she asks, what did I see her do next? And my answer was, at this point, you curl up in the corner, and you call the neighbors to which you gave your daughter, and you... what was the exact thing? Just try and talk to her?
Or was it? And Shannon turns to me, and the answer is... Yeah, hopeful.
Her eyes bright.
Gleaming. And my answer is approximately, yeah, you definitely try and call the family that got your daughter. But in the meanwhile, you are, like, horrified by...
I feel like a cold reptile stare, like, sinks into your soul, and you call the people who have your daughter.
Yeah, no, it was something about being, like, unnerved by the lifeless eyes of snakes glittering in the dark. and also you are worried about your daughter.
Yeah. This is one of the funny things that the system can do, and it is an intended thing. The system understands you can do this, where sometimes both options that you are given are actually the same option with some slightly more detail, and that's what you're going
to
do.
This might happen to Shannon at, like, 3 times.
It's pretty funny.
It's a lot of fun to do to people, and maybe even to her
specifically.
To
Shannon specifically.
Yeah, I think tormenting your... Like, there is a significant element of tormenting your friends available to you in your game if this is what you want to do with your time.
You should play this if you're friends with Shannon.
It's true.
Yeah, no, that is definitely a good use case. We're coming down off Shannon's act two here, and interestingly, by the way, she has heard only suggestions from me, and as I draw my suggestion from the hat, I think to myself distinctly, man, I hope I don't get the one about starting an ill-advised high school punk band that I put in, which is, of course, exactly the one that I draw. That having been said, it turns out pretty okay. My story is about the rise and fall of the Screaming Weenies, a ruthlessly anti-GMO punk band that my character started in high school with his friend Mark, who you would recognize from my first scene. And the scene before the scene that matters is the rise. And the scene that I actually play out, the one with decision points and giving pennies away, is all fall all the way down.
Because even in the rise, it's clear that your character is a fuckass. Like, you are dickish and righteous, and you do not realize how bad your band is.
So, I have a scene that isn't played out where I describe the rise of the Screaming Weenies, and then eventually I carry out their fall on, like, 3 or 4 coins?
I remember you had more coins than the rest of us during this scene, which made it be pretty long, and I thought it was a good scene, but it was pretty long.
Pretty long. And the beats in that scene are approximately, I chew out my bandmates because they're not taking our dull high school punk band antics seriously enough, and then the band breaks up. I meet up with Mark at a burger place, and at this moment, I turn to the assembled crowd and say, like, okay, so I've met up with Mark at a burger place. What happens next? Olivia?
You deliver to him an impassioned speech about loyalty, music, anarchy, sheeple, and what's really important about corn.
Or was it...
You lean in for an ill-advised kiss.
And it's a pretty great moment here, because actually, in my head, I have begun to wonder what exactly the real narrative between Mark and my character is, because we have this childhood memory picking clovers, we have reconnecting after college, and in the middle we have a punk band. And there's some kind of a long thread here, but it's not clear what that is. And in this moment, suddenly a great option appears, and I take it. I go in for that ill-advised kiss. It goes terribly, because this is the unpleasant rent memory recall. And this is actually a moment that will end up kind of defining the rest of my character's story, but it is also, like, the second decision point, so as much as it functions as a perfectly climactic moment within that story, it's a reveal to the person telling the story as well as the people listening. I still have to chew through 2 more decision points, and actually what we end up using them on is the aftermath of that, how Mark and I fall out of touch after I try to make out with him and he's not into it. And there is a passive-aggressive exchange through AIM. Because one of the other factors of my story is that it's deliberately a 90s period piece for some reason. Or, like, 90s and early aughts. So, like, AIM comes up. I think we, like, throw in some band references that were only current then. Maybe we mention, like, TRL or something. But yeah, it's definitely a period piece.
It's not actually a passive-aggressive conversation. You wait until he... And his AIM handle, or his AIM tag at the time, is, I think, Boise Uberalis, fuck you, or something.
Yeah, I think Boise Uberalis, I do recall.
I think there's fuck in it. I think the word fuck appears. But you wait until he's away to send him a message. And then the question is, what did I send him? And I can't remember what Bram said, but I said, you sent him... Nazi punks fuck off, knowing he'd understand.
Hoping he'd understand.
Yeah, hoping he'd understand, and of course, because we're still in unpleasant memory town, he does not.
No, he...
I receive no message back, and presumably I have just sent random angry profanity to someone who maybe feels a little bit weird about his relationship with me, and it all ends terribly. And that is how we fall out of touch.
Not a message of solidarity as you thought it would be. Can we talk for a half a second about what is really great about that ill-advised kiss?
Go on.
Because I think there's more to be said about that. But the first thing is, as you mentioned, it is just a huge left turn, and that's really great. And the second is that it demonstrates something that, at least potentially, the system is very good at, which is a little bit unusual, which is you can take the existing canon and suddenly complicate and redefine it. So we knew it was true. Charles had this friend, his name was Mark, they have this friendship that has this long, weird through line. And what Bram did, in concert with Charles, because Charles chose Bram's option, was to take that canon and to tweak it and to make it something a little bit new and a little bit different. And to say, like, ah, but it's been that way all along. You just didn't know. And that's super cool.
Parallel Kiss. Adventures in Atypical Analog Romance.
Oh, man, though. So now it's probably time to talk about my scene. No, it's time to talk about Bram's scene. Bram, what was your act to?
Oh, I found a teddy bear in the woods because my character is a weirdo, sort of. My character finds a teddy bear, names it something charming that I cannot remember.
Cameron.
For some reason, and at this point, it is not clear why my character cares very much about this teddy bear, and I sure didn't know why either. But my dog rips it up, I kick the dog out, never see the dog again.
I'm pretty sure this dog becomes my fog dog. This is my headcanon.
I'm pretty sure it goes and tries to get into the dog economy, but fails.
This might also be dead dog count number two.
Yeah.
But it might also be my fog dog.
And then I try desperately to find a way to repair my teddy bear Cameron. I'm a grown person now, by the way. But even though I have a lot of money, I can't seem to get it right. And it is a symbol of my failure as a human. And I put it in a box and hide it in the closet.
It's unpleasant because money can't buy a fixed bear, apparently.
Oh, it probably could.
My trigger is like the feeling of cold mud between your fingertips. And I end up digging in the bog for something. And that's what that something is. I have left for college. And when I come home, I discover that my mother has thrown out some of my stuff. And since we live directly in front of a bog, she's just tossed my shit into the bog. And I'm very, very upset. So I go into the bog and I just start digging, sort of determined to find this stuff.
And one of the things that I like about this is actually that it's sort of a mad scene. Like, you are doing this obviously irrational, bizarre thing, and it's a nice moment, because it's one of the first times that we see a character take a turn that drives them towards being the sort of person who could end up with the kind of amnesia the game wants you to have later. Like, right now, my character is just a guy who was in a punk band and went to college, and, like, that happened, and now things are terrible somehow. You are a person who had, at least at some point in your life, this unstable moment of behaving like an actual crazy person already, and later it'll help to contextualize the way you act in your third act.
Shannon, meanwhile, has been crazy the whole time.
Yeah, Shannon's been, I think, an unbalanced and emotionally unsettled person. Whereas this, for me, is my first moment where, like, I do something deeply weird. So I come inside the house, and I'm very angry at my mother, and I don't really want to talk to her. And this is a moment where, actually, No Takesy Backsies changes my game dramatically. Because what happens is, ultimately, I'm upset that she threw out my shit, because that's the part of me that I've left at home. So that's the part of me that is connecting me to my hometown, which, given that I grew up in a beautiful, idyllic childhood, is obviously very important to me. But if I had said something different to my mom, instead of having my hometown be the locus of my trouble, what might have happened instead is that I could have had a dad sad. And I realized instantly, after turning down that option, that my story could have continued to rhyme, but I was not allowed to take it back.
No time for rhyme.
Something that you may or may not have noticed about my character that I'm actually very attached to and very interested in is that my character, unlike the other characters in the game, ultimately never ends up with a defining gender, because that never comes up. Charles's character develops a gender, and then actually an orientation. Bram's character develops a gender. Shannon's character starts out with one.
Yeah, from word one, Shannon's character has a gender. But it turns out, if you're narrating disjointed scenes solely in the first person, it's pretty easy to end up not mentioning, and while I did this, I was a boy.
And it just didn't come up. It was not part of my character's drama. And it's so funny and so interesting to build this character, to develop them, to tell the beginning, middle, and end of their story, and to just never have this feature come up with, which, if I were building a character in a different way, I would consider fairly fundamental and or might put in pretty early.
It's right there after alignment on the character sheet.
Yeah, right there, for sure.
It's also right after name, a thing that none of our characters had.
Yeah. No, your characters will almost certainly never have names unless you shoehorn one in.
I don't think you have to shoehorn, but like... And then my mother called to me. Elias, she said. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you have by shoehorn, I guess I mean you have to deliberately...
Yeah, you would have to introduce it. It's not something you'll just merely end up with.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we played a game with four entirely nameless characters.
Unless there is a possible feature of this game where... It leaves the door open. Different plots can overlap. You'll notice none of ours do. It's just five parallel lives, as it were.
Except for the fog dog.
Except for perhaps the fog dog crossover. But it's certainly possible that you could, although I wouldn't force it, have your lives intersect in different ways. And at that point, maybe you'd know more about each other in terms of what you look like from the outside.
Yeah.
That's true. And if you can get them all interleaved together, you'll have a mid-tier Final Fantasy game.
Or a version of this game that I'm going to talk about later, because I'm still excited about it.
Only Final Fantasy VIII joke for probably the next year.
Fantasy VIII.
The
Squall?
Yeah, it's Squall. No, the big joke, like one of the big twists is that throwaway exposition hidden in a back-ass corner of the game about how, like, magic use has been linked to amnesia, maybe. No one's sure. Yes. All of you went to the same orphanage.
Oh,
everyone in the party knew each other.
I forgot about that. Yeah. What a stupid twist.
Yep. Very stupid twist. Very bad use of amnesia in a game. Also, your like orphanage mom is intermittently a sorceress trying to conquer the world, but only because she is also intermittently possessed by other sorcery from the future or the past, or a compressed version of the future and past merged together. Tune into my Final Fantasy fan cast. Fuck this shit.
Parallel Lives, your sorcerer, Final Fantasy VIII spoilers.
Oh, yeah, by the way. Hella spoilers. Pretty much nothing unspoiled remains, except that you will have to listen to a person with, like, a weird, phonetically spelled out Eastern European accent, name of Ultimecia, describe her plans for world domination. I can't tell you why it's my favorite Final Fantasy, because when I have to describe it, there's nothing to love.
Is there a way that, like, the kicker for this episode can be just, like, that scrolling out? Just Charles.
Yeah, it might be. I can junction it to the end of this episode somehow.
Also, there were junctions. Oh, I sort of liked the junction system.
I think there were things to like about the junction system, but I didn't get it at the time.
You know, it can go fuck itself to death forever. The draw system.
That's true.
Woo! Optimal gameplay consists of standing in one place for 30 minutes every time you find a new enemy whose body contains a new kind of magic for you to pull out of it by pushing.
Everyone liked blue magic. Why not blue magic forever?
Yeah, why not all blue magic all the time? I don't know. I mean, how about instead I just boil down a bunch of, like, dog snouts into copies of fire?
How about
Which
instead,
also I don't understand on a flavor level at all.
How about instead we talk about this game we played?
Final Fantasy, okay, sorry.
You have been awarded seven thunders. Oh, thank goodness this bolt had those.
A gill for my thoughts. That's the money in Final Fantasy, right?
That's good.
Okay, cool.
Oh, good, I'm glad we're just always going to bring up money from other systems. So Act 3 introduces a problem instantaneously, which is Act 3 is where you discover that you end up with total retrograde amnesia.
And if you've been going through the rules as you've been playing, it's also the moment when you, the player, discover. That's not totally true. I'm being glib. Now you're interrupting me. Your dumb lungs.
Olivia is not going to appear in any more podcasts because she'll be dead.
Oh, I won't be dead. I'll be okay. I'm going to make it. Not unlike a dog. I'm not a dog, Bram. I'll be fine.
Foreshadowing.
That you're a dog.
No,
the dogs die.
All right, okay.
So you are actually brief. You know that it is going to be a pleasant, unpleasant how I got amnesia. But if you are like us, you haven't been planning ahead. Oh, that's right, because you can't. You cannot plan your scenes ahead at all, because they must all flow outwards from something you will literally pull from a hat. So you will reach Act 3, and suddenly it will be time to move from whatever you draw out of a hat to total retrograde amnesia, which is a real fun moment, let me tell you.
And, like, not just that, but also from the place where you were to total retrograde amnesia. So this game is very interesting because Shannon's a crazy person, straight up, full on, all the time. So it's not hard to imagine how she gets to total retrograde amnesia from, like, crying in a reptile house in the middle of the night, having called people that she shouldn't have. But me and Bram and Charles are telling much more muted, much more human and normal stories. So figuring out how we're going to ramp straight up into deep and serious tragedy, especially in a world in which we cannot in any way plan ahead, is difficult. Charles and I think, ultimately have an easier time than Bram because our conflicts are seated in our second act. Bram figures out what her conflict is, like, most of the way through your Act 3 scene, right?
It manages to tie it together, and it manages to tie into Act 2, and thank goodness, because I did not know what the deal with that teddy bear was.
Yeah. If you are playing this game, do everything that you can to know what your conflict is in Act 2.
And how much you can do is almost nothing. That's not true. I think we have spoken highly of this game for long enough. We can start to talk about the ways in which the wheels fall off. I do actually think that this transition necessarily from a world in which as little as two facts or two data points in the entire life of your character are known to one where you must then find total retrograde amnesia, major trauma that you blame yourself for in a way where you find healing impossible. It's 1 to 75.
On the other hand, my two-player games have been highly collaborative experiences where both me and my co-player know what we have in mind. And so I think that if you and your co-players are a little bit more in tune with the fact that, like, okay, it's Act 2, so we need to see the conflict. Or, okay, we need to be thinking really hard about getting to total retrograde amnesia in advance. I think that that kind of collaboration probably is helpful.
Okay, so there are balms to this?
I believe so.
Okay.
I draw the card that I was hoping not to draw, not about an ill-advised punk band, but about the zoo that I used to go to with my daughter, which is a memory trigger that I created, thinking about sad zoos, and suddenly I had a daughter.
Karma.
Yes, yeah.
No, in round 3, suddenly a family exists.
Yeah, but what this is my character at this point, reminded of her daughter, decides to go and try and search her out using all her dollars. Or thinking that having been separated will end up being a good thing for her, but of course not. She's dead. And she wasn't really doing much with her life before that, I think. And then the character desperately tries to repair their teddy bear in a way to somehow make it seem like they had control of anything in their life. And things could turn out okay, but they fail to do that as well, and then they burn down their house, which might seem like it comes out of nowhere. I can't remember exactly how it happened.
I think we pulled it off a little bit better in the actual scene.
Yeah, I think you sort of come to the gradual decision. You try to repair the teddy bear again, and you can't, and you come to the gradual decision that, like, everything is broken, and I cannot fix any of it.
Right.
May as well burn it down.
Yeah, my character at this point just abandons their life completely, and that's how they end up in the Orphic Institute. And I was actually the first one to end.
Shannon's trigger, I don't actually remember what Shannon's trigger was. She just, like, her scene is just like, oh, you're my daughter and I'm kidnapping you. We're gonna live together and it's gonna be great. And she is involved in a high-speed chase with the police that. How does that end, Charles?
I can say, actually. She's given the choice between killing her daughter or having her daughter die.
Yeah, I mean...
No, we stick her with a bad one.
Yeah, so I had her drive her car into a ditch that had, you know, just like a foot of water at the bottom and drown her daughter, because if she can't have her, no one can.
My option was you're involved in a high-speed chase with the cops, and you drive into a ditch, the impact kills your daughter.
Charles and I colluded to murder a little girl. So my scene is one of the ones that demonstrates the value, I think, of the prologue, because regrettably it wasn't Charles. My trigger is the smell of old leather. And I think somebody asked me, like, oh, does this smell remind you of someone? You know, it's like, yes, and they're very important to me. And Shannon says, oh, are you glad that he was buried in that old jacket of his? And I decided to go deep and hard into Spicy Town. And I said, yes! And I'm very glad to have it back.
Deep and Hard into Spicy Town is actually the title of the worst pornographic film I ever watched.
So I have to figure out, like, okay, whose grave was this? Why did I do that? And what it turns out has happened is that a friend of mine from my hometown has died. And this death has caused me to feel ultimately completely disconnected from my hometown, which is obviously very important to me. So sort of in a fit of sadness, I robbed my friend's grave. But this doesn't really help. You may notice that nowhere in this scene is my fog dog, who I think has died peacefully off-screen.
Yeah, escaping, no, I think he's just ushered off-screen.
Escaping the cruelty of Charles. So having said that, dead dog counter between 2 and 3 at this point, depending on what happened to Bran's dog that she kicked out of her house. So I return to the city in which I live, and I don't feel connected to this city at all. So I start wandering around in my city at night, and I come, sadly, to another defining choice of the game. Bram asks me, like, I'm wandering around, and I ask Bram, like, what do I do? And she's like, well, you see an open manhole, and you just go on in. And Shannon asks, and I ask Shannon, and Shannon goes, like, well, you go to the Humane Society, and you adopt, to look for some dogs to adopt. So the question becomes, chud or not to chud. Does my character go full weird and become a chud? Or does my character cling desperately to normalcy and do something that might comfort a person who is feeling emotional, like get a dog? And I decide to, especially, and here's another point where, like, the pennies come into it. So on the one hand, I'm digging to find the place where I get retrograde amnesia, because I just don't know how it's happening at this point. But on the other hand, I have like 4 pennies to go, and I really want to be able to get through that. So I decide to do the thing that's maybe going to be a little bit more drawn out. And I think ultimately I'm not unhappy with what happened, but I may not have made the best decision. Because I go to the Humane Society, and I get a dog. And in the parts of the scene that I can control, I engineer a fight between my dogs. I actually get 2 dogs, because I have some dog friends. There's a fight between my dogs and another dog, and I beat the dog who is attacking my dogs to death with a 2x4, dead dog counter, now at 4. I go home and I discover that one of the dogs was bitten by this dog and definitely has rabies. And this leads to the final choice of the game, which is, I think, between Bram and Charles. Charles suggests that I recreate that final beautiful day before I left for college with my fog dog, and on that day poison this dog, which is rabid. Bram, by contrast, suggests that I wait until a foggy day, once again recreating this feeling from my youth, and I take the dogs out into the fog, and I shoot both of them in the head. And because it seemed final, because it seemed to end and break the cycles that my character had been in, I shot those dogs in the head, raising our dead dog counter to either 5 or 6.
Woof, woof, woof.
Yeah.
Woof, woof, woof. That's 6.
That's what I remember.
Fine dog funeral.
Anyways, Charles' final scene.
You broke my
final scene. We've been teasing after this for a while. Each act's main scene is longer than that of the act preceding it. And as you're getting to this, the third scene, third act, those scenes are starting to get quite long. We are heading into hour three of our game at this point. And I am holding, I think, like 6 pennies for this. Might have been 7.
Either six or seven.
Yeah.
Charles went last for this act. And this actually created some very strange problems because nobody wanted to ask him any questions about what they were doing in their own scenes because we would have to inflict a penny on him, which at this point felt like a penalty.
Yeah, I know, because like things were just starting to flag. Like, I think this game is probably best at about 2 hours, but I don't think it clocks in that short unless you either constrain the number of people playing it or start to house rule the way that especially final acts go, because the way that these things work out is that your story's pacing is that it just moves slower with every scene.
And I do think that this is a really easy house rule to put in. I think that you simply say, like, all right, the amount of pennies that you have does not actually matter. In order to do this, the final scene, you have to have 4. If you have more than 4, you can use up to 6 as decision points if you absolutely need them.
Yeah. And that is a workaround. But I don't know. Even then, the game still has this structure where each successive scene is longer than the one that preceded it. And I'm just not sure that that forms an energetic storytelling structure.
I don't know if energetic is the word that I would choose. You're right. But on the other hand, I think the first scene is necessarily short because you don't know jack shit about your character. The second scene is longer because you know a little bit more. And the third scene is A, more important, and B, something that happens at a point that you actually have a pretty good idea about your character, who they are, and what they're about. So it's only in the final scene that you can really get in depth. And yeah. I don't think you can have a satisfying story unless at some point you get in depth.
Yeah, and of course, I suppose it's a little weird to shit on this way that it was structured, because I'm pretty sure that my story barely works with less than 4 beats to it.
I think that's true.
I ended up using most of my story beats in fairly worthwhile ways. To wit, actually, what my scene was, opens with the pain of a broken finger.
Yeah.
And my scene 1 is getting turned down at a bar and punching a man in the face and realizing to my absolute horror that I had never felt more alive since my youth than in that moment punching a man in the face for rejecting me. And I come to terms with the fact that I apparently have like a very large unresolved issue with Mark. And then I undertake a plan. And this is scene 3, my final scene, which is the plot to steal back the clover.
Which is like a harebrained and weird idea.
Pretty weird.
Is another one of those things that potentially demonstrates that your character has come to a weird place in the same way that, like, I had that foreshadowed earlier. I should have become a Chud.
In my head, when I'm setting it up, it is supposed to be this moment in which I'm starting to unhinge and behave in ways that are, you know, inappropriate to my adulthood. Where I'm, like, fixating on a plant that I picked with a friend decade ago, and now it has become the symbol of my unrequited love, and I must steal back my heart, the clover, from Mark. So I concoct a plan to, like, have dinner at his house, figure out where he hides the clover, steal it out from under his nose in a feat of derring do, and everything is going fine until that moment, a decision point at which I must effect the theft. I turn it over, as I must, to the group, who offer me, I think, I forget who it is on this decision. I think it is Olivia and Bram, and Olivia goes first.
You approach the bookshelf, and you look at it, and you say to yourself, this is so fucking stupid, and you turn around, and you walk into the kitchen, and you tell him how you feel.
Or was it?
I cannot remember exactly what I said, but it involved you stealing the clover, leaving without saying another word to Mark, and just being a weirdo.
Yeah, no, I think you were just like, oh, hell no, you take that clover, and you leave, yeah. Or something. Like, it was just really short.
And, oh, hell no, I take that clover, and I leave.
That was a fun moment at least for me, and probably for Bram as well, because, like, Bram and I are playing Shoulder Angel, and so Shoulder Bad Idea. That's a fun thing that you can do in this system.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, you can definitely Shoulder Angel. Shoulder Devil for people pretty easily.
And thankfully,
this is sort of the outcome I need, because this last moment of behaving in this dumb, inappropriate way is my character's big turn, where he realizes that he has not been learning from the past, he has failed to grow up, he is unfit to continue, and if I've learned so little from what I've done, and I'm still just hung up on, like, rejections from high school, what even is the point in, like, bothering to have a memory in the first place? And this is the point at which the pain of that broken finger comes back up again. My finger having been broken, punching a man in a bar who rejected me. And I have a very odd scene from here out wherein I start re-breaking that finger as an elaborate masochistic ritual to remind myself of my sins. As my memory fades, the ritual remains, and I end up
still with a broken finger.
Still with a broken finger, yeah, at the Orphic Institute. Yeah, I close on, like, and why does my finger hurt? Which is that, I ended up using a decision point on that one.
Yeah, you did, because I had fucking many pennies.
Yeah, I had done a whole scene, and I still had pennies remaining, and so I had to blow them on something. And, I thought it was actually an okay workaround.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Was using it to ask a question slightly outside the parameters of the memory we were discussing.
But on the other hand, I think it did a really good job of demonstrating your character's fall into madness.
Yeah.
Basically, like, this person who is just slowly, their memory is eroding, but they have this habit, which is a crazy habit to have, that they keep up until they don't remember why they're doing it. And then until one day they forget to do it. Like, ugh.
And with that, my character story draws to a close.
And that's what you remember.
And that's what I remember. The fucking code phrases, good lord.
At this point, briefly, you all go around and you decide whether or not your characters want to keep these memories. We were about half and half. Shannon and I decided that we were just too broken. And Olivia and Charles decided that they could probably grow past this experience.
Yeah, actually, Charles and I...
Cause for hope, yeah.
Yeah, it was almost exactly a mirror. Like, you and Shannon were like, I don't think we're allowed to have responsibility, and I think this sucks. And I was like, well, I think that I can maybe see my cycles and break them. And Charles was like, well, I think that maybe this experience has actually taught me something and I can grow from here.
Yeah.
Anyways, I think that brings us to about the tail end of our podcast. So let's say you should play this game if you're an amnesiac.
Yeah, so you should play this game if you're interested in the world's longest character generator.
Just the very slowest. You should play this game if you're interested in telling a story bound pretty closely to someone else's aesthetic ideas, with a fair amount of flexibility in spite of that. Like, this game is a very interesting case for both fairly constrained storytelling parameters, but also a lot of freedom in terms of what sort of stories you can tell.
You should also play this game if the idea of playing a tabletop game with absolutely no prep appeals to you. Because the second time I played this game, I literally played it at a party. I introduced someone to the system. He was like, that sounds cool. Do you want to play? And I was like, sure. And then we did.
If you like to see your friends fumbling, great. Go for it.
No, definitely if you like to pranksterishly trap people in shitty situations, you should not play this game if it's really important to you to have full control of your character and their actions. You should not play this game if it's important to you to play one kind of character or to have characters that have some sort of theme that is consistent between them, because you are not in control of those things. You should not play this game if you do not like tragedy or melodrama.
Yeah, that was sort of a discovery of our third act, is that even most of us who've been going on a fairly even keel or having the sort of tragedies that you might recognize from your own life did have to accelerate those, amp up the volume and tack towards melodrama in order to get from, you know, I'm sad that I left home to I cannot reconcile the guilt in my heart over what I've done, and therefore cannot remember myself.
You should not play this game, or not play this game as it is intended, if you feel horrific shame and embarrassment over having to say weird and stupid key phrases over and over again.
We haven't even gotten to the big one, have we? Yeah, we need to talk about the prime offender here. It is necessary.
So at the very end of the game, once everybody has decided whether they are going to remember things or not, you are supposed to all join hands and say, in unison, one last time, a penny for my thoughts.
And I don't know if it was just that we were on, like, hour 3.5, but I think what we did instead, and I think that you'll find this one pretty compelling if you play it, is look at all of your friends and silently shake your head no.
Yep, it's very cathartic and therapeutic end of our session. A penny for we're done.
Penny for out of here.
You should not play this game if rulesiness, crunch, mechanics, combat, and miniatures are for you. This is less than any game that I have played for this podcast about those things. Nope. Not a die is not in sight.
I'm just saying that because we're still, one day we'll have dice. Fiasco barely rolled some dice.
But it does roll some. Obviously, Rookvale.
Rookvale is like an actual RPG of the sort that I'm more used to.
You should not play this game if you hate or are bad at role-playing, and consider not playing this game if coming up with surprises is not for you. We have come up with a couple of sweet, awesome variations on this game. The first of which is make a facts and reassurances document where you're all amnesiac superheroes.
A radioactive spider for your thoughts.
Yeah. No, a chunk of kryptonite for your thoughts. I've been playing this as straight up a character generator with how did you come to be here replaced as the final question with what is most important to you. And it's been going really well for me. The last and my favorite is you're all... Like, I guess it would be a sweet nothing for my thoughts. You are all playing soap opera characters, and so ideally your relationships become entangled. And Charles, you and I were talking last time.
Yeah, the way to do it is probably just overlay some of the fiasco mechanics in such a way that midway through the game, you set some relationships and complications at the start, flip them face down, shuffle them among the players, and later... somehow, in some way, probably involving pennies, doubtless, flip them face up and discover that, in fact, you have a relationship heretofore unknown with one of the characters. They are your long-lost twin, and they are gunning for the family fortune.
Yeah, or, like, you end up with two, so they're your long-lost twin and your ex-wife, and, like, bah! It sounds great. You'd have to actually, like, put that together, but it seems really fun.
Can you just emulate all musical instruments from now on?
No, yes.
I do really like the idea of flavoring this as a bunch of people super drunk, drinking away their worries.
Yeah, no, that also seems fun. Yeah, no, just anything where not remembering shit is germane.
That's a penny for my thoughts, and that's what I remember.
Hey.
That's what I remember.
I hope you've enjoyed this session of Parallel Lives, and thanks, as always, for listening. If you're interested in trying out A Penny for My Thoughts, you can find it at the online store at evilhat.com. You can also find Olivia and Charles at genderfied.tumblr.com or chat me up at your leisure at Wednesday Quest on Twitter. If you like us, and you want us to remember you fondly, please do consider giving Parallel Lives a rating or review on iTunes or Stitcher. It is the surest way to help the podcast grow.
A kitty for your thoughts. New game.
New game.
You have to have at least 4 kittens per person. You put them in a bowl in the center of the table.
Oh, so soft. So
and you have to hand them to someone else when you get new memories.
Well, if they purr, it's a pleasant memory. If they scratch you, it's not.